Hello, and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. My guest this week is Bill Holter, business partner of Jim Sinclair. They are primarily precious metals specialists, commodities, and foreign currency traders. And their website, Jim Sinclair's Mindset, will be in the show notes. There's only one advertiser on this podcast, and their message is especially pertinent now, with financial markets wobbling and gold breaking out of its long sideways churn. You need to own physical precious metals in your portfolio, whether in your possession, in an IRA, or stored internationally. It's imperative that you work with a company that advises you on and manages your gold and silver. ICA has been an industry leader since 1972. Your ICA advisor will get you set up correctly from the beginning and keep you informed about when to make a move, when to add ounces, and even assist you with an exit strategy as markets change. So call 1-800-525-9556 for a free portfolio review. That's 1-800-525-9556. Or go to ICAGoldCompany.com to request information. Well, hello there, Bill Holter. It's great to talk to you after listening to you on other people's podcasts for so long. There's a lot of instability in the world and a sense that things that can't go on won't go on. So let's start with the global debt Ponzi scheme, if we can call it that. There are a lot of financial obligations out there, more than there is an ability for people to pay those obligations. How do you see that whole scene working out?
Well, Jim, first I want to say it's good to talk to you after reading you, I think, beginning in the late 90s.
Oh, we go back that far, huh? Oh,
yeah, I started digging, really digging for the truth in 97, 98, and you were one that I came across that made sense. And I've followed you for kind of maybe lost touch over the last few years, but I did follow you early on. You put out some pretty good stuff.
Well, thanks for that. Can I ask you, what were you doing before that? What were you doing in the 80s and 90s?
Oh, I worked as a stockbroker. I worked 23 years as a broker and 12 of those as a branch manager. I fled the country, if you will, in late 2006. I saw what was coming. And was at that point, if you want to call it, enraged by what was happening to the country. So we left. We were gone for 5 years, and then I came back with my family back in 2011. Been in Texas ever since.
Was it disturbing to come back?
My Spanish got good enough. We lived in Costa Rica, and my Spanish got good enough to understand that gringos, when the system goes down, because they are dollar-based, all of Central and South America are basically, and the world, frankly, mm-hmm. is dollar-based. And when the system goes down, I understood that where we were, even though we were in a compound, we had 24/7 guards around the place, it just wasn't going to be safe. So we decided to come back to Texas and, you know, live this thing through shoulder to shoulder with some people that are like-minded.
Uh-huh. Well, let's get to this question of the debt. Where do things stand in the world? Things are looking a little bit wobbly.
Well, it's more than a little bit wobbly. At this point, it's no longer opinion that it's game over. It's mathematically game over. There's too much debt in the world to ever be repaid. The only way to pay the debt back is to either devalue currencies or via default, one or the other. There's no magical rabbit to pull out of this hat. If you go back 20 years ago, 100%, if a country got to 100% debt to GDP, they were considered putting their foot into banana republic land. Yeah. And now the world is a banana republic. The world is 100% debt to GDP globally.
Well, what has kept the world and certainly the United States suspended in that Wile E. Coyote moment of stepping off the cliff and just hanging there for years?
Well, yeah, we stepped off the cliff in 2008. I termed it at the time. I called it we reached the point of debt saturation. And what I missed, and still looking back, I can't believe it's been done. But what I missed was that central banks and sovereign treasuries would blow up their balance sheets to try to keep the banking game going. And what they did was they threw more debt at a problem that was caused by too much debt. And that debt found its way into markets. You know, they say we have no inflation, but we live in an everything bubble, and that's inflation. The debt was used via derivatives. So in essence, what happened was there was borrowed money that was used via derivatives to price markets. And my partner, Jim Sinclair, came up with a term. I'm thinking it was back in 2005 or six, MOPE, M-O-P-E, Management of Perspective Economics. Mm-hmm. And the basic premise of that is, as long as you have markets that are levitated that you can point to, you can always say all is well. And that's what they've done via derivatives. But now we're to the point where even last week, if you do the math on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, they have a negative net worth.
Last week was kind of an interesting exercise in how this either works or doesn't work. If, in effect, the central banks removed price discovery, okay, simply by manipulating the markets so that there no longer is that function, how does it reappear in a moment like, you know, the last 10 days where the markets have been gyrating wildly? Have they, in fact, lost their ability to disable price discovery?
Well, they're losing their ability to hide true clearing prices. When they actually have lost it, then we'll be in, it's termed reset. We'll be in a reset phase. We'll wake up one day and markets won't open. And when they do reopen, you're going to find true and real pricing.
Is that purely a function of a rush to the exits, that when enough people rush to the exits, the manipulations are simply overwhelmed?
You're correct. It's a function of people rushing to the exits, but it's also a function of credit no longer functioning. Once credit ceases to function, then the capital that has been used to fund derivatives will not be available. And then you're not going to have derivatives that are, call them 50 to 1, 100 to 1 leverage. They're not going to be able to use those to price markets.
Are you talking about really short-term or overnight lending to cover obligations?
Yes, that's the heart of it. But from the heart of it, then you go to 30-day, 90-day T-bills. You go to basically the funding of the system, and the whole system has been funded by credit, not equity.
Mm-hmm. So when people and institutions suddenly freeze up or are afraid of extending any more credit to their partners, then things just don't work anymore.
Right. Or they can't forward credit because they don't have funding.
Right. So there's like a long daisy chain of people depending on other entities lending the money to cover their current obligations.
Right. And think about it on a daily basis. Everything that you do all day long depends on credit. And what I'm getting at here is the most important lifestyle function is distribution. When you walk into your grocery store, there's food on the shelves, and there's food on the shelves because credit has been used 7 times, 10 times to get that loaf of bread on the shelf. Uh-huh. But when credit breaks down, the shelves are going to be emptied. And I assure you, there are not elves in the back rooms at Walmart, you know, making products to put them out on the shelf.
There is tremendous instability out there. And one of the possibilities is that a lot, you know, we're facing a lot of systems breakdown.
You say possibility, and I'm trying to impress that it's not a possibility. It's a mathematical certainty at this point. Because it is a Ponzi scheme. The whole thing, our world is a Ponzi scheme. And once a Ponzi scheme loses new funding, new capital, it's over. It collapses.
How disorderly is this process liable to get?
One would hope that it won't be disorderly, but I think that's wishful thinking. I think you could look at any society that's gone through a hyperinflation, and that's what you're going to see. I mean, look at Venezuela. That's probably your roadmap.
Well, you know, there are a lot of arguments about whether hyperinflation is even possible in the face of so much debt deflation. And how do you see that working?
Now we're in the deflation-inflation argument.
Yeah.
You're going to have both. You're going to have deflation, in other words, lowered prices of the things you own, and higher prices in the things you need.
Uh-huh.
The things you own, your house, your car, your stocks, your bonds, you name it, have been held up by credit.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, the things you need, you buy with basically either dollar bills or digital dollars or whatever. You have to understand that the dollar itself is a credit instrument. It's a credit event that's coming. And that credit event, it will wipe out not only debt, that's your deflation argument, but it's also going to wipe out currencies across the world because they are all credit-based currencies. And when currencies get wiped out, that is your definition of inflation or hyperinflation as currencies lose value.
What is the response of the authorities, and especially the Federal Reserve and other central banks, in the face of this, what you would consider a mathematical certainty of credit disorder?
Well, think about it. What is the only tool that the Fed has?
Printing money, basically.
Exactly. That is the only tool. It's the only tool left, and it's the only tool they've had since 2008. Now they're trying to say, well, you know, we're going to raise interest rates and we're going to reduce our balance sheet. It's that you can't do that on top of a system that is more indebted by any measure than in all of history.
Has the Federal Reserve lost its mojo?
Yeah, because they only have the one tool. They only have an accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to tap the brakes. People look at markets and they're like, oh, well, the stock market was down today. That's not what to look at. What you look at is you look at the credit markets. And credit markets all over the world they're feeling tremors all over the world. And if you have to look at the stock market, then look at the financials. They're the ones that will tell you what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to change the subject a little bit. Have you been paying attention to the relationship between all of this debt generation and the so-called shale oil miracle? And what's your take on it?
Yeah, the shale oil miracle, it works, but not at these prices.
Well, you can do it. I mean, technically, you can do it.
Is it
an affordable industry? I mean, is it a business model that makes any sense?
Well, yeah, it is a business model at $100 or $150 oil and higher. Mm-hmm. At $50 oil, no, it's not. It doesn't work because I think the break even is what, $70, $75 or slightly higher. I mean, how long can you have cost of production at $70 but yet sell your product at $50? Before
sure.
you go bankrupt, and that's what's going to happen.
The catch is that, sure, the shale oil companies can show a profit at $125 a barrel, but that price tends to crush industrial economies at the same time.
Exactly.
So it's a kind of a predicament.
Yes.
You know, every time the price goes up, the economy wobbles, and every time the price goes down, the oil companies wobble.
And the credit edifice wobbles.
Yeah. So what does that mean in the larger picture, especially because, you know, we depend on energy for really everything we do and all the systems that we're using?
Well, it goes back to the old saying, there's no free lunch. With high prices, it doesn't work for consumers. It doesn't work for industry. And with low prices, it doesn't work for the producers. Mm-hmm. So somebody loses.
Our perhaps mutual friend, or at least colleague, Raoul Maier at The Automatic Earth wrote an interesting essay yesterday, and the crux of it was, he said, 2018 was the year of chaos, 2019 is the year of mayhem. We're already seeing street fighting in France and some friction in other European countries. Does this come to the USA?
Absolutely.
How do you see that spinning out?
In the U.S., and it's, I can't speak for Europeans, but in the U.S., it's not only a financial predicament, it's a political point of view predicament. I do not believe it's even close to 50% of the country are snowflakes and 50% of the country are conservatives. I think it's probably more like 70-30, 75-25. I don't believe the results of the 2016 presidential election. I think the elections have been and are rigged. But you do have that divide between the thought process, between the social justice warriors and the people who, you know, believe in their own liberty, standing on their own two feet and supporting themselves.
Well, by the way, you didn't say which side was the 75% and which was the 25%.
I think that 75% are still, if you want to call them, patriotic Americans that prefer adherence to the Constitution, yeah, prefer to stand on their own two feet, and prefer what has been or had been the American way of life.
When you say the elections were rigged, I'm reluctant to suppose that you mean rigged in favor of Donald Trump. What exactly did you mean by that? Are we talking about like the kind of pervasive, casual, you know, voter registration shenanigans and ballot box shenanigans of the type we saw in Florida recently?
No, I think they're rigged in every way imaginable.
How were they rigged in the presidential election? Apart from the hysteria about Russia, what's your take on that rigging for 2016?
Well, let me ask you this. For instance, you go back to the 2012 election. Mm-hmm. How is it possible that there were precincts in Philadelphia where more people voted than were registered and not one single vote went Republican? Every single vote was Democrat. You're trying to tell me that not one single Democrat made a mistake?
Okay, then we are talking about the kind of shenanigans that went on in Florida just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but they're all over the United States.
Yes.
Okay. And somehow the authorities seem to have kind of just missed it.
Well, Jim, it doesn't matter who you vote for. It matters who counts the votes.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, look at the Democratic primary. I mean, that was stolen from Bernie. Mm-hmm. And not that I agree with Bernie. I mean, I think the guy's a complete lunatic when it comes to how he believes the country should operate under socialism. But he did have that primary stolen from him.
Yeah, well, that's true, of course. But
that's a fact.
But the kind of rigging that you're talking about, for example, in Philadelphia and probably other, you know,
Detroit,
Democratic cities.
Yeah, go through the big cities.
It still did not result in Hillary Clinton getting elected. So it was a failure.
Correct.
Right.
And now the current Russia, that's their response to it.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. That is now reaching a pitch that is just unbelievably insane in this country. What's your take on the Robert Mueller Russia collusion investigation, and especially its potential to destabilize our political system?
It was all premised on a dossier that has been factually proven to be, you know, completely made up. The very start of it was bogus to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're running with it. They ran with it with the FISA warrants. In my opinion, you're going to see after the first of the year, I believe you're going to see some massive arrests for all sorts of corruption, voter fraud, and the red line that I think a good percentage of the social justice warriors won't be able to handle is pedophilia. I think there's going to be a very large amount and some very well-known names are going to be arrested for child trafficking.
Well, we've heard quite a bit about this in the deep background of events over the last 2 years. I've been wondering personally, what do you think is preventing Mr. Trump from releasing all of those documents? Why is he waiting until after January 1st to do this? Why couldn't he have done it, a month ago?
If I'm not mistaken, the executive order that he wrote last year takes effect January 1st of 2019.
Yeah, and I've been seeing a few items about this executive order. It's a kind of a mysterious thing. Could you explain it to listeners and tell us what that represents?
Well, I mean, broadly, it talks to corruption, fraud, and human trafficking. And it also talks about the ability to seize assets of those found guilty. Mm-hmm. Let me just add to that.
Sure.
You asked, why hasn't anything been done?
Yeah.
If you think about it, let's say that we were having this conversation a year ago, and as of January 1st, 2018, all of a sudden you saw a bunch of arrests. Without a doubt, and going back to Judge Kavanaugh being questioned prior to, accepted and voted in by the Senate, he was asked for 5 minutes by Lindsey Graham regarding military tribunals. That question has never been asked to any prospective Supreme Court juror. What I'm getting at is the Supreme Court had to be firmly 5-4 because what we're headed to are going to be some groundbreaking arrests and trials. Some will end up in the Supreme Court. And without a 5-4 mandate, it wouldn't work. So in my opinion, for the last year and a half, the DOJ, the FBI have been making cases, dotting every I, crossing every T, locking cases up completely airtight to bring the cases to trial. We do know that there's, 63 or 64,000 federal sealed indictments. That's unprecedented.
My impression is that the Department of Justice and the FBI are kind of involved in their own agency civil war.
Yes.
That, there is a contingent of people on one side and on the other side. And somewhere in there is a terrible vacuum of authority. For example, I don't understand why Rod Rosenstein is still in a position of authority as Deputy Attorney General. And I don't understand why Matt Whitaker, the acting Attorney General, has just faded into the woodwork over the last several weeks. I don't understand why Mr. Huber seems to be on another planet in his investigation. And the Inspector General seems to be kind of AWOL. So there's this weird vacuum of authority out there. And is that where the whole idea of military tribunals comes into play?
If you have a hand that's four aces or a royal straight flush or whatever, are you going to tip the hand?
Interesting point. But can you expand a little bit on, what I just asked you? This vacuum of authority.
I don't think it is a vacuum of authority. I think the last year and a half has been a period of time where the Trump administration is sitting in the same position that the Obama administration was sitting in when they authorized the FISA warrants. First, I think the left was very, very sloppy going into the 2016 election. They did all kinds of things, absolutely knowing in their minds that Hillary was going to become president and nothing that they did would ever see the light of day.
And actually not knowing how sloppy she was.
Right, exactly. Now, I think for the last year and a half, we're seeing that through text messages back and forth. I mean, they're following text messages, emails, telephone calls, even Xbox conversations. And I think those are the I's that are being dotted and the T's being crossed. I think all of that information has been gathered for the last year and a half. And so they leave Rosenstein in, they leave certain people in to not stir the pot up so much that all of a sudden the left just gets so scared that they get quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They've allowed enough hope that Trump is going to be impeached or whatever that the left is still talking amongst themselves and it's being monitored.
Do you think Mr. Mueller is included in the indictments that may be coming down?
I think there's a good chance of that, although there is also a chance that he flipped a long time ago.
Flipped to who?
Rather than being a bad actor, they told him, we have you. You either play along or you're going to go down now.
Did you happen to tune in to General Flynn's hearing yesterday in the D.C. court?
No, I didn't. I did see the aftermath of it. Very, very strange.
It's a very mystifying kind of session they had there.
My hope going into that was that because the judge asked for the original 302, I thought he was going to look into the case and just throw it out and say, you know, there's nothing here. And this was an egregious miscarriage of justice. Then he told Flynn that he could withdraw his plea, take more time or whatever. I'm thinking to myself, okay, withdraw your plea. Yeah. But he didn't do that. So, I mean, I don't know. I think Flynn's lawyers may have given him bad advice. And then the real strange twist was the judge coming out and talking about treason on Flynn's part. Where it stands now, I don't know where it's going.
I have read quite a bit of interesting commentary over the last 2 days, and there seem to be a lot of hidden agendas in there. But we don't need to go on that much longer. How important is that, by the way? How important is that whole Flynn business?
Right now, it's important because it goes to the rule of law. When all is said and done, it could be a ruse. Like I said, I really after the judge brought up treason on Flynn's part, which is ridiculous, I really don't know where it's going.
Well, that might have been some kind of an admonition to Mueller's team.
Could be.
And that's one of the theories that's being floated around out there.
That's possible.
As you're looking forward, just in the medium-term future, what do you expect the financial condition of the country will be in June of 2019?
We believe that there's going to be two resets, meaning there's going to be two panic moves in markets. And the first panic move is going to be responded with the IMF, the SDR from the IMF, replacing the dollar.
Now, let me stop you there. I think virtually no normal people have a clue what an SDR is. It sounds like the most abstract sort of instrument or arrangement or something. Nobody really knows what the hell it is. What is it?
SDR stands for special drawing rights. It's a currency, if you will, amongst central banks that was used back in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, to facilitate the clearance of trade. And basically the SDR is a basket of currencies, the dollar, the pound, well, not the pound anymore because that's gone, but the euro, the yen, the yuan was added last year, I believe. It's a basket of fiat currencies and they have a small amount of gold. I think they say that they have 3,000 tons of gold.
Are they the obligation payer of last resort? Is that the idea?
It's supposed to be the idea, but it's a basket. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. It's a basket of crappy currencies.
So it's a basket case.
Yeah, it's a pot of turds is what it is. It's not. There's no value to it.
Why does anybody put any credibility in it? It sounds like something that is one level even more abstract than fiat currencies themselves.
It is, but it would be a last gasp effort of the current elites trying to hold on to power.
So they institute that reset using special drawing rights as some means of keeping the system stable. I think there's a good prospect that it won't work. And so what happens next?
I don't think it'll work more than 90 days. Okay. And then you get panic number two. And panic number two is when gold comes back into the system marked up at unimaginable prices as of today, but that will back central banks, and the gold will not be convertible, but the gold will be used to back currencies on a ratio basis.
Well, other major players on the world stage have been accumulating a lot of gold for years.
And there's a reason for
that. Are they preparing for currencies backed by more than sheer faith and trust?
Well, there's a reason for that, because they see where this is going. They see that mathematically the dollar goes away, and then what's left? Right now, and this is down from 10, 20 years ago, right now nearly 60% of the reserves that central banks worldwide hold are dollars. So when the dollar goes away, something has to fill that void. Going all the way back to Mao in 1971, when Nixon took us off the gold standard, Mao was quoted as saying, "Now the end of capitalism is in sight." So they know. The Chinese certainly understand fiat currencies because they've blown up 20 of them over 2,000 years.
Why do you suppose the United States has not been accumulating gold? Or, to put it another way, do we actually still have a lot of gold? I know there's a lot of controversy over what we actually possess.
Well, we haven't had a real audit since 1956. Yeah, and there's a reason for that. And the reason being, gold has been bleeding out the back door for years and years. And I'd be surprised if we have 1,000 tons left.
So where does that leave us then?
Well, it leaves us in a bad position financially, because gold is money. Foreign entities knew this, they know this, and that's why they're accumulating gold, because they understand that gold has been money for 5,000 years. It's certainly going to be money for the rest of our lifetimes. And the great experiment of fiat currencies is going to end, and he who has the gold has wealth.
What does it look like on the ground in everyday life after this second reset occurs?
Well, the average person is going to see their savings wiped out, because the average person in the United States saves in dollars. Mm-hmm. And if you wake up and we've had reset number one, where you had a big ding to your wealth, and reset number two, where dollars basically go to zero, and you have banks left and right going under via debt defaults, etc. The way I put it is, when this thing goes down, you're going to have what you have at your house, you know, on your land or whatever, and that's all you're going to have.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the houses are mortgaged anyway, so how does that work out?
Well, that's going to be interesting. If you go back to the Weimar Germany scenario, mortgages were actually rewritten mm-hmm. based on gold grams at the time of the purchase of the home. So now if that happens, you're talking about the masses losing their properties. On the other hand, you could possibly see some type of jubilee, because the banking system at that point will pretty much be non-existent. I mean, we're going to have to come up with a new banking system based on a new currency. Who knows what they're going to call it? Who knows what the ratio backing to gold will be? But they're going to have to come up with a currency that people will have confidence in.
Do you think that the authorities will survive in their institutions to be able to even do that? Because I'd be very worried about the whole institutional framework of the country imploding.
The only way for that to happen would be to go back and go 100% strictly with adherence to the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm.
If we're going to go through some kind of a real damaging storm that's going to destroy institutions, what is our potential for actually reorganizing the country? Or does it just not reorganize the way that it used to be? Does it become something else, you know, a basket of kind of competing regions or what?
Yeah, that's a possibility. If you go back to what I just mentioned about adhering to the Constitution, what is the definition of a dollar? The definition of a dollar is in grams of silver. Mm-hmm. There was a bimetallic gold and silver. Money could only be gold and silver. You're going to be looking at an entirely different world. Do institutions survive? I'm sure an awful lot of institutions will be completely closed, gone. You're suggesting that we go to four or five different regions, you know, and call them new countries. That's a very real possibility also.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine remarked that financialization was money with its value removed.
Right.
Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, that's correct. That's what has been happening.
Mm-hmm. It would seem to be the end of financialization, of the whole process of pretending to create wealth by the manipulation of complex securities. And the complexity itself seems to have been a tremendous hazard.
Well, if you look at the way, and this is really perverse, but the way a lot of people calculate their net worth is by how much debt they're able to accumulate. It's not about assets. It's become about debt.
Are we facing a more general decomplexifying of everyday life in this country?
I think we are facing going back to basics.
Like how, like medieval basics or what?
That's very possible. I mean, think about it. The credit system goes down. Do you really believe there's going to be a police presence that's going to come to your door when you dial 911? If your phone's working, if the power grid's up, if water's being purified, I mean, there's a very real chance that for a period of time, you're going to be 100% on your own, which means you better have some way to protect on your own.
What do you imagine might restore order in an emergency like that?
The most basic would be trust. Trust in real money. Trust that if you're a farmer and you got chickens that lay eggs, that if you give eggs to somebody, they're giving you something real in return.
Well, there's not a whole lot of gold and silver to go around, so that if it comes down to that, the prices of those things is going to have to be increased.
Simply because
the supply is so small.
I knew you were going to get to that. That's the argument. There's not enough gold and there's not enough silver to do that. I would say, yes, you are correct at the current price or pricing. But if you had gold at $100,000, $200,000 an ounce, or you had silver at $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 an ounce, would there be enough?
Well, what that says to me is that a money system would have to be reorganized so that you then have some sort of a paper certificate that is being traded that represents a fraction of what an ounce of silver would be. Because, you know, if an ounce of silver is that much, you know, you're probably going to see them hoarded. You can't trade them for apples and wheat flour.
Well, for a period of time, that would be necessary until a trustable system arose where if you were going to accept a piece of paper, you trusted that the gold or the silver is actually in a vault that piece of paper represents.
Mm-hmm.
Trust is going to have to come back. And the only way for trust to come back is for money to be based on something real.
Have the gold miners been demoralized by the price of gold and silver? Well, both miners, gold and silver, the price being so close to the cost of production?
Yeah, they've been destroyed, and there's no financing. The mining industry is so capital intensive. It takes a long time. It takes 7+ years once you even find metal on a property. It takes 7 or more years to bring a mine to production. But bringing a mine to production requires huge amounts of capital. And that capital, it's a capital-starved industry.
Well, given the credit freeze-ups that we anticipate, and also the quality of the ore grades that they're dealing with and the scale that they have to do the mining at to make the money, it seems possible to me that gold mining may have to stop for a while.
Right, and what does that do to the price?
Well, it would constrain the supply, obviously.
Right. On top of the world finding out that on COMEX, for instance, there's 382 paper ounces represented that actually have only one real ounce available for delivery. So there's 381 people that are going to find out they don't have the gold that they thought they had.
Uh-huh. Yeah, how corrupt are these gold exchanges now?
1,000%.
Who do you think has been behind these strange bumps up and bumps down and all the volatility in the markets that have, in effect, produced a strange kind of range-bound flat price?
To answer your question, who? I don't know, but I can tell you it's been done via derivatives. I mean, when you have a day where 2 billion or 5 billion or even 10 billion or even more in gold futures is sold within a 5-minute period of time, that shows you that it's that market is 100% outright fraud.
It kind of reminds
me. Nobody has $10 billion is the point. If you had $10 billion worth of gold and you wanted to sell it, you would never sell it all in 5 minutes.
Sure.
And then the question is, who has $10 billion in gold? And the answer is no one other than central banks.
Do you think that the government would dare to try another gold confiscation sometime in the near future, a la the 1933 event?
Yes.
It seems to me that there are too many guns in this country to make that work too well.
Well, let me expand on that. I do believe there's a good chance that there's going to be a confiscation. And I think it's very wise. If you're in the United States, you want U.S. Mint lineage coins. If you're in Canada, you want Royal Canadian Mint lineage coins. I can envision here in the U.S. where it's ordered that any gold, any silver that's not either pre-64 junk or silver eagles or gold eagles or pre-1933 double eagles, those will be considered contraband. They don't have to go door to door. All they have to do is say it's illegal to own them. You have to turn them in. Then if you're trying to barter with a Canadian Maple Leaf or a bar or a Krugerrand or whatever, the person on the other side is going to be skeptical of accepting it.
Sure. I've argued a number of times in The Long Emergency and other books that one of the main features of the future would be that governments would become increasingly impotent and increasingly unable to manage their affairs. And that seems to me to be a theme for 2019. I wonder that they'd even be able to do anything like that or enforce it. Because an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think if you sat and held on to your metal long enough, there may not even be a government to enforce any rules.
Well, I could see a situation where something like, you know, a casual sort of minting operation would arise where people would simply bring their Krugerrands and their Maple Leafs and, you know, have them converted into something else.
Right, but that's something else, if it's not a U.S. Mint lineage coin,
uh-huh,
would still be considered contraband.
Okay, so, well, what about a gold nugget?
Yeah, under that scenario, a raw nugget, good question. But treasuries, I mean, just look back through history. Mm-hmm. Treasuries, time and time again, have to come up with some way to fill their coffers. And if gold and silver have come back into the system as monetary backing, then somehow, some way, Fort Knox has got to be filled. Uh-huh. And they could do it with a tax on mining companies. And that tax has got to be paid in gold or silver.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like if they try those things, they will, in one way or another, disable the system further. As per my previous question, there'd be a lot, you know, there are a lot of people out there holding Krugerrands and Maple Leaves and other forms of 1 ounce coins, and they have a lot of guns.
That's correct.
And they're pissed off.
That's correct.
You know, they're pissed off in a way that you didn't see in 1933 when we were a much different nation of highly regimented factory workers, or, you know, former factory workers, the ones who got laid off in the Great Depression. But, you know, in many ways, it was a very docile kind of citizenship.
Well, and that was an era where neighbor helped neighbor. And in this era, a lot of neighbors don't even know neighbors.
I'm just curious, you know, since you mentioned that you've been reading my stuff for quite a while, where do you think the fiasco of suburbia fits into all this? Because it seems to me that on top of all the other problems we're having, we've got a living arrangement that is absolutely unsustainable and has no future. And I don't see how any of that stuff works out in the kind of scenarios that we're spinning.
My comment on that would be, we've got these cities with 1 million, you know, 2 million, 5 million people. I think that's going to be the most dangerous place to be. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you're talking about suburbia. I would go one step further and say living in a rural area is a better choice.
Many of the cities in the United States now are majority suburban fabric, you know, places right. like Houston and Dallas and L.A. and they're cities, but they're basically just suburban sprawl.
Right, exactly. They've sprawled out.
And you know, if we see the kind of credit failures and banking disorders that we're talking about, then, you know, the gasoline's not going to be in the pumps.
Well, that scenario will certainly cull the population of cities a lot faster than it will cull the population in rural areas.
Are you envisioning a problem with people not making it?
Absolutely.
How's that work?
Well, think about it. I mean, try to go home on a Friday night and live through the weekend with just what you have. I mean, there's a lot of people that don't have 2 days worth of food stored up.
Uh-huh.
Electricity, water. I mean, you name it. Everything, like I said at the very beginning of our talk here, everything relies on credit. Mm-hmm. And if credit breaks down, you're going to see the biggest problems in cities where people cannot provide for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Tom Friedman at the New York Times a decade or so ago put over the idea that globalism would be a permanent feature of the human condition, yet it is apparently unwinding. What's your take on that?
I think that was the goal, was globalism. And I think globalism is going to fail. It's going to fail along with credit. I think nationalism, I mean, just look at what's happening in not just France, but Belgium, Holland, Britain. Nationalism is rising.
Mm-hmm. Hey, by the way, do you see the internet failing? I actually can't imagine it's going to work too well if we have any problems with electric service.
It's a possibility.
The reason I bring it up is because so many people assume that the internet is also a permanent installation in the human condition, and I'm not so sure about that.
Well, I mean, if we got to the point where you had an exchange of nukes or EMPs or whatever, yeah, I mean, the internet could certainly fail. And again, that's back to basics.
Mm-hmm.
My question to that is, you know, you got these millennials that are wild about Bitcoin. What's your Bitcoin going to be worth then? I mean, millennials, somebody told me recently, you know, gold and silver will never come back into the system because millennials don't believe in it. They believe in Bitcoin. And my response basically was, you know, you got a bunch of millennials living in their parents' home or in their basement or whatever that play video games all day. They come to believe that video games are real. And if you get killed, you get an extra life.
Yeah.
I mean, Bitcoin, crypto, I have no doubt that cryptocurrency, that the blockchain is going to be used or try to be used by governments just for the fact that you can track every transaction. But mm-hmm. the current cryptocurrencies are digital air.
By saying that and assuming that the internet persists, are you saying that these digital national currencies would somehow be backed by gold?
Yes, on a ratio backing. There's mm-hmm. you have to get the people to accept the currency. And the only way to get them to accept the currency is via confidence by the public to accept the currency.
Mm-hmm. In your mind, what's the picture for geopolitical relations in the year ahead?
Assuming that the U.S. does begin to turn back to the rule of law, I think geopolitics could begin to heal. And I say that because at this point, anyone who has done business with the U.S. for the last 20, 30, even 40 years knows that when you do a deal with the U.S., you don't really have a deal.
Mm-hmm.
So if we turn back toward the rule of law, maybe we can begin to get some trust back with foreign countries and heal our bad reputation.
It seems that you're talking about the basic enforceability of contracts.
Yes.
At the bottom of the rule of law.
Yes.
Finally, I'm kind of wondering, just personally, just from observing the scene over the last 2 years, what do you think the trajectory of Mr. Trump is over the next year or so?
Again, a lot depends upon whether or not we turn back to the rule of law. Do the wrongs and misdeeds of the past 8 years, 16 years, 30 years, do they go unpunished? If they go unpunished, I mean, I could see the House of Representatives absolutely dog Trump, you know, for the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you wake up January 1st and we start to see some arrests, some high profile arrests, and people that no ifs, ands, or buts should have already been in jail. If you see them arrested, convicted, and, you know, go to jail or even hung for treason or whatever, I think you'll see the Make America Great crowd. You'll have them jumping up and down for joy. And I think you'll see a good percentage on the left saying, you know, this is a good thing.
We're going to conclude on that note, on that somewhat ambiguous note. So I want to thank you for coming on, and it would be great to touch base with you in about 6 months and see how this is playing out.
That'll work.
So we will ride again, and it's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Okay, Bill.